You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Lowe's knows you want the best for dad. This Father's Day, help him take on any project with big deals on DeWalt. Right now, get a free XR 8 amp hour battery when you buy select DeWalt tools. That's not all. Get up to two free select tools when you buy a select DeWalt 20 volt max battery kit. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a work load is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
The Westwood One Podcast Network.
One of the things we try to get across to the world when we tell our story, everybody to know who the true heroes are, because as career police officers, we've been called every freaking name in the book. I mean, there's names that I wouldn't even repeat on the radio to you guys because they're so nasty. But now people say, oh, now you're true American heroes. No, we're not. We're just a couple of professional law enforcement officers that got to work a really big case. The true heroes of this whole thing is the Columbia National Police, because they took their country back from this piece of shit.
Never quit radio. All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Imagine a single cream that addresses all your skincare needs. Wrinkles, dark circles, age spots, and more. Introducing Caviargon Skin Cream, the only argon, caviar, and retinol formula on the market. Packed with pure Moroccan argan oil, collagen-boosting caviar extract, and retinol, Caviargon deeply hydrates, firms, and rejuvenates without the irritation of traditional retinol. Trusted by women over 45, Caviargon delivers visible results in just weeks. Smoother, firmer, more radiant skin. It's not just possible, it's proven. Visit Caviargon.com today to claim your jar at up to 72% off. That's Caviargon.com. Again, that's Caviargon.com. Experience the luxury your skin deserves.
For a limited time, we're giving away a free Guasha system, a $70 value, with all triple bundle orders.
Hello there, TNQ Nation. Welcome back to another episode. Hope you guys are having a great day so far. I'm grateful to be joined by two of the most badass podcast host on the planet, Marcus Luttrell, Morgan Luttrell. Good morning, guys.
Morning.
What's happening?
Top of the morning to you, buddy.
Here we go again. Again.
I think they wrote a song about that.
Here we go again. Again.
How's y'all's weeks?
Man, I've been everywhere this week.
Me too. Every day is a great day.
Every day.
Yeah, I like, man. Christmas every day I get up.
Some days living in an RV is not a great day.
That's your own fault.
Well, you living in it all day?
I try to get out of it. I just sleep in there mostly.
Well, was that part okay?
Bad.
Yeah, the sleeping part's fine.
Well, then, all right then.
The kitchen part is the part that I have not, like, adapted to yet.
What about the shower?
Yeah, you know, I'm cool with the shower. I'm all right with it. I mean, it's a little short. Like, my head is definitely touching
every
the
day
roof.
You should be cooking on that pit.
Oh, yeah, I try to cook on the pit. I also bought one of those Blackstone griddles, just a flat iron.
That's all you need, man.
That thing is awesome.
George, that's all I cook on is a cast iron.
George Foreman. Do you have one of those?
I don't.
That was my go-to when I was traveling.
We started with that. That and that Instapot.
I've heard a lot of good things about the air fryers, too.
I don't even know what that is, but it sounds awesome.
I've seen those. I cooked the KFC recipe, slipped out online.
It did?
Yeah.
Like the real one?
Yeah, yeah.
Like the head-to-toe legit KFC?
The 23 herbs and spices.
What?
And, yeah.
Can you literally Google that?
Yeah, I did. And I cooked it at the ranch. I don't think you were there, but there's this one girl, she does the difference between an air fryer and just a regular oil fryer.
Yeah.
With the 23 herbs and spices. And when the crust is real thick, sometimes the air fryer won't, you'll see some of the flour layers.
Oh, it's
still
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
I mean, but you'll always notice the difference. I mean, there's the taste, right?
Yeah.
You grew up one with the greasy fried chicken.
I like that
fried
grease.
Supposed to be greasy. But, yeah, it was good.
And that's sad.
And then I did the, I had some halibut.
It's terrible.
I cooked the Long John Silver. That recipe is out online. Long John Silver fish batter.
As soon as the Coca-Cola one comes out,
I don't think that one's coming out.
I'm quitting.
There's only two people that know that, right?
I don't know.
That's I think the awesome guy who knows it and keeps it, when he's time for the pass down, he opens up, hands it over, and then it's
kind of like the fleur-de-lis.
That's cool.
Angels and demons type thing.
I can't even eat fried chicken anymore. I started keto this week.
Have you had one of those Popeye?
I did have it prior to this week.
Was it epic?
The Popeye's chicken sandwich is pretty epic.
Man, they're always out when I
spent my young times working at Chick-fil-A. And it's better than Chick-fil-A, which is maybe sacrilegious to say, but that Popeye's chicken sandwich is
I was talking to a group the other day about leadership, and if you think that you can't take a 17 to 24-year-old individual and make them into something special and what you want, walk into a Chick-fil-A.
That's right. That place taught me a lot, going from there and then to Apple. They taught me what I know.
Senator Joni Ernst worked at Church's, I think it was. Fried chicken. I think it was Church's. And now she's a senator. First female from Iowa, military vet. She's pretty
awesome.
Much the awesomest thing ever. I love her to death.
Awesomest.
She is.
Badass.
She's totally awesomest.
All right, let's get to a listener story.
Listener stories today is my Army buddy from William. So the story I'm going to share with you guys is not really my own, but my best friend's, an Army buddy, Kenny. During our first deployment to Iraq, Kenny and I became really close. He has an amazing voice and was great at turning any good song into a funny one. Kenny and I were always together and always making each other laugh, along with the rest of the platoon. I always gravitated to the funny guys, and during the hard moments, the laughs just kept us going. When Kenny deployed a second time to Iraq, he convinced the sergeant major to have me work with him at the B-Doc. I was deploying later due to getting treated for PTSD from my first deployment. When I arrived there, it was like no time had passed. We laughed all the time, like always. Kenny worked the day shift, and I worked the night shift. One night, we got a call, and I was told to go to Kenny's chew right away because Kenny was going to kill himself. My sergeant and I, in a panic, drove over to Kenny's chew, and it still haunts me to this day. His front door was open, just a crack, and I had mentally prepared myself for seeing my best friend dead on the bunk. When I walked in, Kenny was sitting on his bed with the muzzle of his rifle underneath his chin, ready to go. My sergeant waited outside. Kenny was crying and very upset because his wife was leaving him. No one had a clue he was even suffering. I said the first thing that came to mind. Kenny, if you do this, you won't just fuck yourself up, but you'll fuck me up as well. Kenny started bawling. My sergeant got the chaplain, and I got the rifle away from him just in the nick of time. He told me everything he was dealing with. They took Kenny's charging handle from his weapon for a week, and a couple of buddies and I would make him laugh constantly by pulling it back even though it wasn't there. Kenny went on not to only finish his deployment, but also him and I doing a third deployment together. Him to Afghanistan, where he earned a Bronze Star for teaching kids, and I ended up in Iraq again. I am out now, and Kenny is still fighting the good fight. He is in the reserves now. About 2 years ago, Kenny ended up with cancer and beat that too. Kenny and I both went to the E5 board together. Kenny is my motivation to never quit, and I wanted to share this with you guys because whether you are in Kenny's shoes or my own, helping someone who is on the edge, it is important not to just think about your current situation, but also what you can do to become if you just push through it. Kenny and I were both in the 1st Armored Division, and the quote that I will die with is, "Iron sharpens iron as one iron soldier sharpens another." I love you guys. I work out to your podcast every day. Never quit doing what you do. It's so important. That's an amazing story. Will, thanks for sharing that with us, buddy. And I'm glad to see that Kenny's out still kicking ass and taking names. You're right. It only takes just that one small intervention, walking in and saying, "Hey, man."
Everybody gets put to everybody for a reason. The universe has a funny way of making you wind up exactly where you're supposed to be. I read that on a bumper sticker somewhere or something, but it's true, man. It's
thank both you guys for your service.
Yeah. And thanks for watching out for each other. That's what we do.
All right, guys, it's that time of the day. We got a Patreon question of the day. Today it's coming from Gary, and Gary asks, what's the most difficult thing in your life that you've had to adjust to in the civilian world?
Oh, what? I got that one. I would say the most difficult thing to adjust to is having to slow way down, because people don't operate in the same parameters as we did in the service, where it's not a, you don't have a set time that you're going to work. You're just going to work. And when you, in the civilian world, when we were tasked with doing something, everybody else was like, hey, it's 4 o'clock. It's time to go. It's frustrating because, you know, in the world we just left, this took years for me to get my head around.
Yeah, I say for every 2 years you're in, or excuse me, for every 10 you're in, it takes about two to detox out of that and just kind of curb your battle with them around. So a lot of people think when they get out, if they're high rank, if you've been in a long time, you made a lot of rank, you got a lot of responsibilities. When you come out, people want to go right into a CEO position or something like that. Think about it from their perspective. If they've been working there, it's kind of like the son, you know, gets kind of put into the boss's spot instead of working from the mailroom. Like, you know, the dad who puts his kid in the mailroom makes him work his way up. You get more respect. You get to see kind of each layer of that. Just like when we joined the military, we had to start boot camp first, and then you went to get your job, and then you started working in it. I mean, look at your life as there is no, you don't ever get out of the academy. So as soon as you start school, you start school, and you spend the rest of your life in it. It's just in the first 12 to 14 or 16 years, of, or excuse me, 18 to 20-something years of it, it's in a building. And you kind of learn about what's out there, and that gives you an idea of what you want to pursue and what your comfort levels are. A lot of people look at the military, and we're in a uniform, and we stand in line of formation, but that's just kind of the first couple parts of it at muster, just to make sure that everyone's okay, you know, if there are any problems, and getting your marching orders for the day. And then we all go out and do our prospective jobs. And in the military, it's just like it's like a nuclear family. We have doctors, lawyers, accountants, guys who work in gyms. We have guys who play baseball, who go on rodeo, and everything. You got the younger brothers and sisters behind you, and the olders ahead of you, and we're all kind of policing each other up. And the rank we wear on our uniform is to denote kind of where you sit in the family. And then you get a job, you work at it, you get better at it, and you go do the next job. You take your older brother, or eventually then your dad's position. There's one thing I've learned, it's that sharing your story is a powerful thing. There are people out there that need a kick in the ass, and your story could be the one thing to change their life forever. Take a minute to share your story at teamneverquit.com/podcast. Just click on the Share Your Story button in the menu so we can encourage you along the way. Your story just might be shared on one of our upcoming episodes.
Do you want exclusive access to the show and bonus behind-the-scenes content? Ask your questions for the guys on the episodes. You're going to want to join us on Patreon. You're going to get exclusive access to behind-the-scenes content, access to the exclusive Patreon community where you get support others, and you can get rare access to Morgan, Marcus, and all of our incredible guests. Join us at patreon.com/teamneverquit.
Imagine a single cream that addresses all your skincare needs. Wrinkles, dark circles, age spots, and more. Introducing Caviargon Skin Cream, the only argon, caviar, and retinol formula on the market. Packed with pure Moroccan argan oil, collagen-boosting caviar extract, and retinol, Caviar Gone deeply hydrates, firms, and rejuvenates without the irritation of traditional retinol. Trusted by women over 45, Caviar Gone delivers visible results in just weeks. Smoother, firmer, more radiant skin. It's not just possible, it's proven. Visit CaviarGone.com today to claim your jar at up to 72% off. That's CaviarGone.com. Again, that's CaviarGone.com. Experience the luxury your skin deserves.
For a limited time, we're giving away a free Gua Sha system, a $70 value, with all triple bundle orders.
All right, let's get to the interview.
I've been doing a lot of homework on you guys, fascinated by your stories and everything that that you've accomplished, and the way, even where you're going now, never retire. I greatly respect that. I think if you retire, you kind of pass away. Yeah, you slow down, you start to die.
Don't let the old man in, right?
Can you guys give us kind of a little background on, most people are, I think they think the DEA and like the letter agencies and the military, they think that that's unattainable. How did you guys... First, how'd you kind of pick that role, and then how was it for you to get in and get rolling?
Well, for me, since I was a little kid, I just wanted to be a cop. My father was a Southern Baptist minister, and we grew up in a pretty strict household. But, you know, that was the norm back then. Nowadays, people would probably put my dad in jail for some of the stuff that he did to us. But that was life. And you know what? We knew what was expected of us.
Sure thing.
So, you know, we knew what you could get away with, and you knew what you were going to be punished for. But when he retired from the ministry, him and my uncle opened up a flooring store in Nashville, Tennessee, and we're pretty successful at it. But they decided they wanted to go back to where they're from in West Virginia, southern West Virginia. So as I'm getting ready to go into high school, you know, he upped the family and moved. My sister stayed in Tennessee, and I went with my parents. And, you know, at age 10, I had a run-in with the cops. A bunch of us were camping out in Tennessee, and, you know, it was a nice, warm summer night. We're out getting into mischief, and it's probably 2 o'clock in the morning, and we decided to break into a house. Now, the house belonged to one of the guys that we were camping out with, and we needed change because we want to go to the vending machines and get some crackers and some sodas in the middle of the night, you know. Well, I guess one of the neighbors saw us, so they called the cops. Well, this was probably in the 67 time range, 1967. And the cops that showed up scared the crap out of us. I mean, they shined a light on us. We were petrified, afraid to move. And after they talked to us, they said, you know what, boys, you got an option here. You can go to jail, spend the rest of your life in jail, or we can take you home to your parents. All looked at each other and said, take us to jail.
Take us to jail. Then we said the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Jail sounds easy right now.
Yeah, and they did just like you did. They laughed, took us home to our parents. It's probably punishment worse than death. But that just kind of stuck with me that, you know, the older men looking good in their uniforms out there working the midnight shift had common sense, and they were allowed to use common sense, you know, which police officers will do today given the opportunity. But, we, you know, with all these different movements and acceptances that are going on in the world, that's just not the way it is in a lot of places now.
Sure. Yeah.
But that's what kind of got me involved in law enforcement. I ended up being a uniformed police officer in a place called Bluefield, West Virginia, 1975. I was all of 19 years old.
Oh, wow.
You know, the funny thing about that story is, you know, you had to be 21 to buy a gun. I couldn't even buy a gun. One of the police officers bought my duty weapon, and my dad bought my ammo. I could carry the gun. I could shoot you if, you know, deemed it appropriate. I could put you in jail, but I just couldn't buy a weapon.
You can't even be a police officer now at 19, can you? You have to be 21?
You did back in 1975.
Times have changed. All right, outstanding. Javier, what you got, buddy?
Yeah, I grew up in a little town called Hebronville, Texas, South Texas.
Love it, man. I love hunting there.
Yeah, a lot of hunting. In fact, we have a ranch there, a lot of big deer. The wild pigs are taking over now.
They are here, too.
All over the place. But, yeah, good hunting. Anyway, so I started with the sheriff's office in Laredo, 1977. I started off working at the jail. I did about 7 years. And, you know, back then I told people we were making, I think it was like $10,000 a year. I was 19 years old, man. You know, and I saw at our bulletin board, I was just getting my degree there. And it was an A&M branch in Laredo. But anyway, so posted on the bulletin board was the sign says that DEA was hiring and starting salary was $17,000. And to be honest, I did not know what DEA was. I had to ask this guy. He's after the federal marks, man. So I applied. It took about a year and got accepted. And then, you know what, my first job, I wanted to go to a big city first. Miami, L.A., New York. They sent me where? To Austin, Texas. Wow. In Austin at that time, I don't know if you know, man, that was the music industry. That was the start of the music industry.
Yeah. Still.
Straight. So I had a great time in Austin. Then from there, I ended up in Columbia after that.
How, we'll kind of jump into the, because I can't wait to hear this, but how did you guys get picked for the Escobar case? I can only imagine that was probably one of the higher profile cases at the time. And I think like anything else, it's really selective who gets put on what duty. How did you two?
Well, you know what, and I'll go first. I got to Bogota in 1988. I did 4 years in Austin. Now, my boss from Austin lived in San Antonio. He was the what they call the ASAC, Assistant Special Agent in Charge, Joe Top. Anyway, so I worked for him in Austin. And, you know, I was, you know, single. I was running all over the place with the cops, had a lot of stats, a lot of cases going. And then when I put in for Mexico, And then my boss says, yeah, did you put in for Colombia? I said, no, sir. I said, I put in for Mexico. He says, well, you got selected for Colombia. I said, all right, let me go look at the map where Colombia is, you know. And it was all, and then I get to Colombia. And then my boss from San Antonio got the big boss in Colombia. He got the country attaché, so he knew me. And I get there, and I don't know who Pablo Escobar is, I'll be honest. This was in 88. And he says, Javier, we're assigning you the Pablo Escobar case. I said, okay, let me go look it up. And, you know, so I learned very quick who Pablo Escobar was. But it's anytime you go to a foreign country, it's a voluntary assignment. And then, like I said, it was just my boss knew my work ethic. You know, I was a worker. So I got assigned the case, basically. So I had to learn right away.
What was life like in Colombia at that time?
Yeah, that's a great question. The life, you know, in Colombia at that time, you know, the attitude was, and I'm going to be, you know, kind of honest, the attitude there was the office was in a stalemate type stuff. You know, a lot of the older guys would say, you can't trust the cops, don't go, you know, don't work with them. And man, so we started going out there and we started finding out that if you tried, the cops were going to help you out, you know? It's like, anyway, so, but when we started, like I said, the Escobar stuff and, you know, his base was in Medellin, Colombia. It was something we had never seen before. And like I told people, well, car bomb, I never heard, you know, I've heard what a car bomb was. I've never seen or heard one. Then, you know, when Escobar started the war in Colombia, his primary focus was car bombing. I mean, 10 to 15 a day, you know, really? Shopping centers at our base. We used to live in our police base in Medellin. And once we would leave our base, it was in a neighborhood, you know, type of area. So we would leave. There'd be people who would call them, hey, the convoy's leaving. So they come in and park a car nearby, blow it up. You know, a lot of our guys got killed that way. But, you know, that to me, that sticks in my mind. Plus all the other, you know, all the other terrorism that he committed. But it was Wild Wild West, basically. You know, two guys on a motorcycle, man. If you see two guys on a motorcycle, you better get out of their way, man, because they'll get back. The guy in the back was going to shoot you. That was one of their favorite ways of killing people.
What was the ROEs for you guys? I mean, if you saw somebody, could you engage right away, or did you literally have to let them open up on you first?
Well, we had authorization to carry weapons down there, but you guys know you have no jurisdiction, no legal jurisdiction down there. We did have diplomatic immunity. For us, the ROE was if it's life-threatening, you could protect yourself. If it was your counterpart police officers, you could engage with them as well. But, you know, of course, you want to protect your family down there. We didn't have – it was just my wife and I, and Javier was single, which is why he had all his girlfriends down there. Mm-hmm. So, another story.
Man, I bet you had some fun.
Allegedly.
Who knew a guy who had some fun down there? So to relate that to common life here in the States, it's completely different when people don't understand what a car bomb on the side of the road going off all the time means, or people riding down. It's literally like a war going on in your town, right? I mean, it's kind of that threat level.
Yeah, just exactly like you said it. And you said, and it was, you know, it was parked cars. It was that you were at a restaurant. And all of a sudden, you'd hear that, you know, I call it a muffled sound.
Yeah.
And, you know, that black smoke, you know, I mean, guys, you've seen it. But it was just, he was placing them at places that you never expected it to be placed at. Shopping centers. He put one at a bookstore where kids and parents were buying their school supplies. He put them in parks and restaurants, right next to restaurants. He was targeting, like you said, his main goal was to kill as many people as possible, and the purpose was to convince Colombia to let him get his sweetheart deal. That was the whole purpose.
That's ultimately what turned the people against him, right?
The sweetheart deal was to be charged with one crime and exonerated from the rest of the crimes, correct?
Right. And the main thing was to live in his own created prison. His own prison that he was going to build. That was the other one.
Man, that guy had some stones on him, man, to be tossing that out.
That's a joke, isn't it?
Yeah, a joke. Everything's on the table. When, like, some, a lot of times with, when, like, a civil war, no wife, no kids, right? You can't mess with them or anything like that. But that guy, it was a free for all.
Well, that was the thing. So one of the things that you probably heard the saying, plata or plomo, silver or lead. Do you want silver in the form of money or lead in the form of a bullet? And Javier tells a good story about the first judge.
Yeah, the judge, you know, the judges run the cases in Medellin. And now, you know, so a couple of sicarios, you know, nicely dressed, they walk into the judge's office who had the main case on Escobar. And basically, before the secretary could stop them, they just, you know, went straight to the judge's office. And the first thing they did is show him a picture of his wife at work. Oh. The judge, is your wife at work? Judge, are this your kids at school? So that got the judge's attention. Then they started, hey, we're being sent by Pablo Escobar. And they said, here, we have a briefcase. Here's $100,000, sir. All you got to do is drop the charges against Pablo Escobar, and this money's yours. The judge then kicked them out. And you can imagine what happened the next day. They killed him, his wife, and his kids. So people got the message. And from there on, people started accepting those briefcases. And you know what? I do not blame them for taking those briefcases.
Most people here can't imagine that scenario when you're having, especially to come into a judge or law enforcement and throw a threat like that. Because if they can do that to them, they can do it to the common people. And a lot of people think that because the war is going on and the drugs are going on, that everyone is like that. Man, there's those people that are trapped in that environment.
Yeah, and you know what? And there's a lot of other examples. And, you know, just the main ones. I know we don't have that much time, but the main one is another, the Attorney General. If you Google Rodrigo Lara Bonilla, the Attorney General of Colombia is like our Attorney General in the United States, right? Anyway, this guy was in favor of extradition, which we loved, man. We loved extradition. Oh, let me throw it out. You know what the main Escobar's fight was over? Extradition. He had a saying, I prefer a tomb in Colombia than a jail cell in the United States. So the moral of the story is all these traffickers all over the world, what's the only thing they fear? They fear coming to the United States to a jail cell. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Rodrigo Lara Bonilla, Attorney General, is in favor of extradition. What happens? Two guys on a motorcycle sent by Pablo Escobar, the guy in the back shoots. They killed the Attorney General. Tell them about, Norway.
Yeah, we're just like you. We're on the speaking circuit. We travel around the world. We're in Norway. We're doing a northern Scandinavian tour. We're in Norway. And at the end of the show, the manager of the venue comes in and says, hey, there's a young Colombian gentleman out here who wants to speak to you. Well, first of all, that's not a comfortable feeling to know a Colombian man.
Sure.
Because we're not carrying weapons. And we discussed it. We said, sure, bring him on in. We figured the two of us want to have. Well, you know what? It comes in. He's in his mid-20s. Turns out that he was the nephew of the Attorney General, Lara Bonilla, that was killed. He said the next day, and when Pablo killed you, he didn't kill you. He killed your entire family.
Right.
The families knew that, so their family joined up together, and they moved to Norway the very next day. This kid now is in his mid-20s. He's grown up in Norway, speaks no Spanish, speaks like five other languages, but he can't even speak Spanish. But that's the lengths they had to go to protect their family because his uncle had the stones to stand up and call Escobar what he was, a drug trafficker.
And 20 of their family members had to leave Colombia. Imagine 20 families packed up the next day. You need to get out of here because Pablo Escobar's coming for you.
I was going to ask you, two questions, I guess. Did you ever actually see or address Pablo? And have you since the Day of Days run into any of his family? Because I know his son is out and about. I saw an interview with him.
Yeah. No, the only time I ever saw Pablo Escobar was when I was standing over his body taking those pictures.
Okay.
And we have not physically seen any of his family members. Our agents have called, where they want us to go on stage with him. There's the son. There's one surviving member of the Medellin cartel. They call him Popeye. I hate to even give him any recognition, but he's the only surviving member of the Medellin cartel that we're aware of. And our agents wanted us to go on stage with him. This guy admits on camera that he killed 300 people himself, murdered them. And he admits on camera that he arranged as many as 3,000 murders at the direction of Pablo Escobar. Jeez. And they want us to go on freaking stage with him?
Yeah, we will never do that.
Yeah,
we'll never.
I mean, he would go into martyrdom right there probably.
We will love not. And like Steve said, Juan Pablo, one of his producers called us, wanted us to talk to him. I said, of course not, we will not talk to him. And but you know what? This people is like Popeye. You know what? And we put the number of Escobar's killed people that he killed at about 10 to 15,000 people. Popeye claimed to numbers closer to 50,000 people that Escobar killed.
So. That's almost, that's like genocide.
It was.
Yeah.
It was. And then you go back to the deal you were talking about. We call it the deal of a lifetime. He got to plead guilty to one crime that he got to select, an unwittingly participating in the transport of cocaine. That's, you know, I had no idea it was in the car. And for that, he's absolved of every other crime he committed in his life, including tens of thousands of murders.
Right, right. But he couldn't stand it. He couldn't stand being in jail, right? So,
right. Now, and you know what? His deal in jail, I don't know if y'all know, but, I mean, it was a great deal. And you know what? We also throw it out sometimes. You know what? If you're in the leadership or you're the president of Colombia and you're seeing all your people get killed and you have a chance, I'm not saying that was righteous. I'm just saying that's the other side of the coin, mm-hmm. to let him surrender. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
We didn't like the deal. Of course not. We were very opposed to that deal. But if you're in charge and you have a chance to, hey, this guy says he's going to surrender, stop the bombing. And you know what? When he surrendered, the bombing stopped. No more people were getting killed. You know what I'm saying? I'm just throwing it out.
How is it that he became that power? If you have a functioning country that was there established before him and it'll be there after him, and a governing, a military, how is it that he, and everyone knew he was doing that?
Yeah.
How is it he acquired that much power?
That's a great question. I mean, wow. And we've thought about it. We were there. We saw it. And I think it was just the terrorism, the sicarios, I remember one of the, it was a Saturday night. I'm at the base and the informant called and we were offering, I think, $5 million,
right? Million.
For the reward. Steve won there. It was a Saturday night. Anyway, so the informant says, no, I'm only want to talk to Peña. And she, because, you know, they knew we were paid, right, for the reward money. So anyway, she said, hey, and I always remember it was a really bad sicario at a club dancing. She says, I have him inside. He's dancing with a friend of mine. So we rounded up a couple of cops who were at the search walk. We went up to the disco. And, obviously I knew who the guy was, so I arrested him. He tried fighting. A couple of cops then came in. We subdued him. But anyway, we took him back to the base. And, it was just that cocky attitude, and he confessed. And that's something that guys, you've seen it, that where people say, you know, I will die for Pablo Escobar. I will kill for Pablo Escobar. You know, you all saw that attitude, you know, obviously, you know. And it was then he confessed to me that he already killed 10 police officers. And Pablo had put bounties on police officers, $100 a head. Can you believe that? $100 a head. So he confessed to me he had already killed 10 police officers. But that the attitude was, he says, I will kill for Pablo. I will die for Pablo. He has given me money. And money goes to where? To my mother. My mother has got a shelter. She's got food. And I tell people, you multiply that attitude by all the other sicarios Escobar had. So that was that terrorism base. And it's something we're not used to. We never dealt with this type of stuff. You know, car bombs, I never seen one, you know. Then all of a sudden you're thrust into that that terrorism war that he created. So, it was an ugly war. It was, I'm saying ugly in that a lot of innocent people got killed. A lot of police officer friends of ours got killed. And, but I don't know. I mean, he just got so powerful, and I blame it on the terrorism, you know.
Imagine a single cream that addresses all your skincare needs. Wrinkles, dark circles, age spots, and more. Introducing Caviar Gone Skin Cream, the only argon, caviar, and retinol formula on the market. Packed with pure Moroccan argon oil, collagen-boosting caviar extract, and retinol, Caviar Gone deeply hydrates, firms, and rejuvenates without the irritation of traditional retinol. Trusted by women over 45, Caviar Gone delivers visible results in just weeks. Smoother, firmer, more radiant skin. It's not just possible, it's proven. Visit CaviarGon.com today to claim your jar at up to 72% off. That's CaviarGon.com. Again, that's CaviarGon.com. Experience the luxury your skin deserves.
For a limited time, we're giving away a free Guasha system, a $70 value, with all triple bundle orders.
Can you take us, if you don't mind, through that day, through in 93 when you finally, we had him, and how kind of high level, it had to be just a rush, just to know, all right, hey, this is it. And then finally when you realize, oh, this is really it.
Let me go first because Steve's got a good story. My story, it's, you know what, the irony. You know what, I got there in 88. I chased him since 88. And that last day, I wasn't there. And it's funny now, but, you know, not it wasn't back then. But, you know, I get a call from the ambassador. And the ambassador, I don't know how, there's an informant named Navigante. And I say his name because he wrote a book. Anyway, so he's the guy who really put the Gotcha, the other trafficker was Gotcha. He got killed in 89. We infiltrated him and he led us to Jose Gonzalo Rodriguez Gotcha, who was Escobar's partner. Anyway, so he's now in Miami and then he calls the ambassador and says, hey, I want to talk to Peña, but I only want to talk to Peña because I know where Pablo Escobar is. So the ambassador calls me in Medellin. He says, you need to get on a plane, go to Miami. There's an informant who's going to tell you where Escobar is. I said, Mr. Ambassador, all due respect, we're close. We know we're close on him. We're going to locate him here in Medellin. The ambassador did not care. He says, and you know, guys, you know, the ambassador, they're like the president of that country, right?
Right.
The order. And the irony is, you know, when I get to Miami, the irony is the informant, Navigante's on the phone, and then he covers the phone and he looks at me, and we don't even say hello. All he says is, Javier, they just killed Pablo Escobar. So like, shit.
that sucks.
Yeah, I go back to the airport, and you know, at the airport, man, on the plane I get on, and it's all the television network people, Telemundo, you know, going to cover the story. So that was my story. That's why I wasn't there. But Steve, yeah.
Can you imagine what would happen on that plane if they knew who he was and he was on the plane?
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So for me, it was, so obviously traveling up to Miami, so I'm in Medellin with the Colombian National Police. And you guys probably know we had operators from Delta and Team 6 with us for 18 months there.
Right. Yes, sir.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you know, you get to be friends with everybody because we're all pretty much on the same mission there. We had different responsibilities, but still the same mission. And so I'm standing in the room with all the operators and it's, you know, just seeing what's going on. And, you know, you've got your different things. You go to the wire room, you go to the 800 hotline and all that stuff. And out in the quad, I could see all the executive staff for the Colombian National Police scurrying over to the colonel's office, Colonel Hugo Martinez. He was our boss up there. So we had a great enough relationship that we could go to the colonel's office and you know, he would invite us in. So I go to the doorway and stand there. He sees me and he motions me in and he's on a walkie-talkie. And you can hear there's an operation underway. And one of the lieutenant colonels whispers over, they think they found Pablo. And the colonel's issuing orders. Long story short, you know, the Colombian National Police is this elite unit that's known as the Dijin unit, D-I-J-I-N. They're the ones that engaged Pablo in a firefight that day. It was funny because they used deck cord to blow the door off of this row house he was in, and that was the operators had taught him how to use deck cord. So they actually employed some of the explosives training that they had learned from the Americans. They go inside, they engage in a firefight. Pablo, now this was a little surprising for us. Pablo only had one bodyguard. You know, this guy at one point had as many as 500 sicarios working for him. This day he's got one. So we knew his power base was dwindling and his funding was dwindling and all that. So the bodyguard, they go up to the third floor of this row house. He jumps out the window onto the roof of a two-story row house behind him. He's trying to make his escape across the roof of that two-story. And a couple of police officers in the back engage him, and they kill him. He falls off the roof. Well, Pablo makes it up to that third window, and one of our good friends on the Dijin unit, he had just come around the corner, and I think this is portrayed in one of the trailers. He's sighting in on Pablo. Pablo shoots at him, but he trips on the steps and falls down, which saved his life because a bullet went right over his head. Then Pablo jumps out the window. He's down on the second, on the roof of that two-story row house, and he knows there's a crossfire going. He knows, you know, there's going to be good guys shooting at him from the third floor here shortly. He knows there's guys on the ground, so he's trying to make his way along the building there. But you can only go so far, so he makes a dash. The guys show up on the third floor, get him in crossfire, take him out there on the roof. Now, if you watch the show Narcos, it shows that I was on the roof when Pablo was killed. Uh-huh. That's not true. I was back at the base.
Damn. This,
that might be one thing to say about, but you know, one of the things we try to get across to the world when we tell our story, everybody to know who the true heroes are, because you know, as career police officers, we've been called every freaking name in the book. I mean, there's names that I wouldn't even repeat on the radio to you guys because they're so nasty. But now people say, oh, now you're true American heroes. No, we're not. We're just a couple of professional law enforcement officers that got to work a really big case. The true heroes of this whole thing is the Columbia National Police because they took their country back from this piece of shit.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. And you know what? Kind of interesting. When he was living at that house, he had a taxi. He was getting around in a taxi. And if you see the pictures, he was just real fat, beard, you know, kind of, I mean, when I saw the phone, that Pablo Escobar, because we weren't that sure, but he had infiltrated a little, you know, lower class type of neighborhood, was eating at this restaurant where all the people ate at. After he got killed, people were saying, man, he was always at this little restaurant dressed like a campesino with a, you know, that coat black, you know, they wear beard, a hat. You know what I'm saying? Blended into that little neighborhood.
Yeah, what was the atmosphere like the next day? Or he had to be living like just like a rat. I mean,
he was living just, you know, in a simple type house, eating simple type food, had, like Steve said, had only one bodyguard towards the end. Because you know what, one of the successes we had and we learned is how to do how to take out an organization. You got to take out everybody, the sicarios, the money launderers. So we were concentrating on everybody. I remember the big money launderers, we were arresting them. And we were doing joint operations in Miami. You know, anybody who worked for Pablo Escobar, we were targeting them. Columbia was targeting them. So that was one of the factors that helped us, is go after everybody in the organization. So, and we would intercept some of his letters, and he was, you know, asking for money. You know, because he had money, but he didn't have the cash. So he was living towards the end in just a regular, you know, because I think the work that the search block did in taking out all his organization.
And you'd ask about the mood. You know, it was actually a mood of elation.
Yeah.
Not only with us, but with the Columbia National Police especially, because they lost thousands of police officers to this guy and his organization. So all the photographs you've seen of Escobar on the internet or wherever you might have seen him, I took those pictures. A lot of them, I did have some pictures of the team that killed him. You know, I'm in the third floor window shooting down on the second floor, on the roof of that second floor where the body was. And, you know, we've got the pictures of them holding their rifles in the air. Well, there was a major with Columbia National Police that took those pictures out, so I never got those back. But then, you know, when the media started showing up and thousands of people started coming out because, I mean, you know how they are. There's a firefight and then people just scurry out because they want to see death and destruction and mayhem.
Right.
Well, one of the lieutenant colonels came over. He's like, listen, man, we want to get you out of here. And I said, believe me, I want to get out of here. I'm from an English-Irish background. I'm about as white as you get.
Yeah, you don't blend.
Sticking out like a sore thumb there.
Yep.
So they gave me a patrol detail. We headed back to the base. And that night, after everything was over, I mean, we tripled the guard. And the police base in Columbia is like a military base that you guys are used to. So they tripled the guard. We're expecting retaliation attacks. Quietest night I ever spent meeting Columbia was the night Pablo Escobar was killed. Next day, Javier's back in Bogota. They fly him in on a Huey gunship out of the base. We fly back to Bogota that evening. My wife was in the embassy. They had arranged a little celebration. And, you know, we all got home like first light the next day. It was a hell of a night.
It was. And everybody, I wasn't there, but you know what? It was part of that that great feeling, you know, because this guy, like you said, and it was personal for us. I mean, sure. He killed a couple of good friends of mine. You know, I tell people we went to a funeral where we had seven coffins in the church. You know, the main guy was a, you know, good friend of mine. So it was personal. The Colombians loved it. They were happy. Some of the Medellin people obviously think Pablo Escobar is still a hero. And we have dispelled that myth. But he still has followers in Medellin. Why? Because he gave him a new house, gave him money. You know what we tell people right now, the number one tourist attraction in Medellin, Colombia, is his gravesite.
I was going to say, is there a site there that...
How's that?
I was going to ask if there's a site there that people visit.
Yeah, the gravesite, man. People go from all over the world. They come, they want to go there. They started, I don't know why, narco tours, where Pablo's brother, Roberto, and he's kind of, I'll say it, he's crazy. He's not all up there. He's doing narco tours. We're showing them where Escobar had properties. People are paying money to go look at this stuff. I mean, it is unbelievable. And, you know, that prison, the so-called prison he was living at, you know, the main goal, you know what he was going to do after he, you know, after he left after the 5 years, was he was going to turn it into a tourist bread and breakfast type place.
How much money? And it was, I know it was estimated he was making $18 million a day. How much is there? Do you think there's still money out there buried and hidden to be found?
Yeah, there's a lot of money buried in caletas, and you're going to hear that word, caletas, anywhere. It's a stash site. It's a famous word in Colombia. You can hide it. But, yeah, there's still a lot of money buried because they used to kill everybody who buried it. You know, Escobar is dead. You know, and there's been documentaries. They're trying to find it. It's going to be hard. I tell people, you know what? You're not going to be able to find it unless weather conditions wash it up.
Right.
You know, storms, rivers, stuff like that. But yeah, he loved to bury the cash. And at that time, it was all cash that was coming back to him in Colombia. They were experimenting with the banking system, and we're still finding accounts in Switzerland, you know, that this organization had. But a lot of it was cash being buried. So yes, there's still a lot of money buried there, but not unless you were involved in that, you're not going to be able to tell where it is.
Wow. I wonder if he had like a grid system or...
I can only imagine. It's kind of like when Bin Laden went down, there's this weight lifted, like an accomplishment deal. I mean, sitting on what you guys just went through, and I mean, good job chasing that foreign man in a foreign land. You guys integrating out there as your own two-man reconnaissance team, and then with the local police. That was the best part when I was watching Narcos, was when you guys integrated in with Los Pepes, right?
And, right.
Well, that's a whole other story.
Yeah, that's a different.
Hey, let's shift gears for a second, because I was reading that you guys are on a new adventure searching for American remains from American Flight 229 before the war, World War II. Yeah, am I right on that?
Yeah, the Hawaiian Clipper, Pan Am Hawaiian Clipper.
Pan Am Hawaiian Clipper. Yeah. Can you guys talk about that and give our listeners a? That's fascinating.
Yeah, we've got a couple of buddies that help us with our videography and editing, and they're professionals, and they have this project. So the lead guy is a guy named Guy Mofsinger. He's a retired naval intelligence officer. When he was going through Staff Command College, his thesis was on this Hawaiian Clipper, this Pan Am Airways. They had these, I think, three or four seaplanes they called Clippers. This happened to be the Hawaiian Clipper. And through his research, he found out that it disappeared after it left Guam with 15 people, Americans, on board. And through his research, he believes that while the plane was in Guam, you know, they had to island hop because they didn't have the fuel capacity to make a full trip. Right. They're on the way to China. So while they're in Guam, when the plane took off the next morning to go to the next island, there are witness accounts that say that the plane was skimming across the water, and it looked like it was tail heavy, and then it finally took off. Well, the theory is that two Japanese spies secreted themselves in the back of that plane. The plane was huge. I mean, there's compartments everywhere that you could hide in. And, you know, people weren't expecting, like today, we would probably search the plane before we got on it, but back then they didn't do that. Well, what we believe is that the two spies, when they hit the point of no return, came out with weapons, skyjacked the plane, forced it to land in Truk Lagoon over in Micronesia. if you know anything about Truck Lagoon, that was Admiral Yamashita's Pearl Harbor. That's
where
the Japanese naval base.
I've been there. It's a long way down there.
And today it's the best wreck.
Ooh, isn't it? Man, it is.
Imagine a single cream that addresses all your skincare needs. Wrinkles, dark circles, age spots, and more. Introducing Caviargon Skin Cream, the only argon, caviar, and retinol formula on the market. Packed with pure Moroccan argon oil, collagen-boosting caviar extract, and retinol, Caviargon deeply hydrates, firms, and rejuvenates without the irritation of traditional retinol. Trusted by women over 45, Caviargon delivers visible results in just weeks. Smoother, firmer, more radiant skin. It's not just possible, it's proven. Visit caviargon.com today to claim your jar at up to 72% off. That's caviargon.com. Again, that's caviargon.com. Experience the luxury your skin deserves.
For a limited time, we're giving away a free Gua Sha system, a $70 value, with all triple bundle orders.
It's beautiful down there. So what we believe is that they took the 15 Americans off there. They held them captive there for a while. We've got statements from family members down there. We were down there. Guy has been on 4 expeditions down there. I went on one about almost 2 years ago. We went down for 2 weeks and we're digging for bodies. We're trying to find artifacts, bones, whatever, witness accounts. Javier and I are the lead investigators of the Lost. We call it the Lost Clipper. We believe that the Japanese, based on accounts from family members, took the 15 Americans, made them lay down in a plot, like 4, 4, 4, and 3. That's 15. And then poisoned them. Then they put rebar over top of it, poured cement on them, and that's their grave. So we're trying to find the bodies. But the reason for the skyjacking is the Lost Clipper had the newest, latest, and greatest engine technology for aircraft. So the Japanese wanted that plane. They took it to Japan, reverse engineered those engines, and those are the engines they put on their Zero fighters that attack Pearl Harbor. So if we can prove all this, and we also now think it's linked. This is in 1938 when this happened. If you remember history, in 1937 when Amelia Earhart disappeared.
There it is. Yeah.
We believe the two are linked. So if we can prove all this, we may finally be able to put a definitive answer on what happened to Amelia Earhart. If we can prove this, this will be the first skyjacking in the history of the world. And if we can prove this, the first act of war against the United States by the Japanese won't be Pearl Harbor. It'll be the skyjacking of the Hawaiian Clipper in 1938.
That's amazing.
So thinking that Amelia might have landed on that island and they...
Well,
how's that work?
Not sure. We believe she ran out of fuel. You know what? We believe that Amelia was a spy for the United States also. I mean, we've uncovered some evidence that supports that theory. And I don't want to reveal too much because...
Riveted.
No, it's. I tell you what, I got a chance to go down to. We flew out of Guam into Palau and down to Micronesia. Went diving down there. We were with an organization called Bent Prop, and we were searching for there was 3 frogmen that were captured and tortured on Saipan and moved out in that area, and we're in a prison of war camp, and they found some of the remains. It's like walking back in time back there. I mean, literally, rifles leaned against a tree. There's tank treads everywhere. It's something. That place, it is. I imagine there's treasure everywhere. Because the crazy part is that how deep that reef is. So what is it, like 60 feet? And we dove on one of those P-51s, and the only thing that was, it looked like somebody had rolled it off the showroom floor. Just the prop was bent on the front of it, and it had a couple of bullet holes through the fuselage, but that wooden antenna was still on the back, and a coral had grown up through the middle of the cabin. But, you know, you go off that reef and then it's, 2,000 feet straight down? But, and if you guys never stop going on adventures. I mean, that's awesome.
You know what? That's what life is. It's an adventure. Just because we're old doesn't mean we can't go on adventures, right?
Oh, I ain't old, man. Just experienced.
Yeah. You got a lot of knowledge.
There's been on a lot of adventures. In this family, every day when you wake up, we say you go out. It's an adventure, man. So make it fun. Especially now you get to search for all our buried treasure, which is our buried history. You guys dig that up, man. That's something. Because every book that's ever been written, every movie that's ever been made is waiting to be relived and rewritten just with the next generation. And the best part about it is when you're out there on it, you get to discover the things that got overlooked from our past. So that's, man, that's good stuff, man.
You know what? We may bring some closure to the 15 families too for those
victims. There you go. Right there. That's amazing. All right. Well, we're going to wrap this up. If you guys are good with that, thank you for sharing that story.
Yeah. If you could just, I mean,
we got any plugs?
Let everybody know where we can find you, how we can follow you, how we can help you out.
What you got going on next? Something we can share with everybody.
Yeah, there's. If you want to find out more about us, you can go to our website, www.deanarcos.com. We've got a calendar on the shows where we're speaking at, where we'll be next. A lot of fan photos, information about us. We're all over social media on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We've got Vimeo channels. We've got YouTube channels. We've got professionals that do this for us. We're on LinkedIn, all under DEA Narcos. And on November 12th of this year, our first book is coming out. It's called Manhunters, How We Took Down Pablo Escobar. St. Martin's Press is our publisher. You can pre-order it now. If you're having trouble sleeping at night, it'll probably help you cure insomnia when you read the book. And it's a little bit more than just our story about Pablo. It's about our personal lives, how we got involved in law enforcement, some of the other cases we've gotten to work on over the years. We're also doing a project that's addressing, we're working with a group called Partnership for Safe Medicines. This is addressing counterfeit medications that are coming to the United States, which primarily contain fentanyl.
Fentanyl, there you go.
And all the scourge that is. And you know what, guys, you probably already know this, but in 2017, there were 72,000 overdose deaths in the United States. If you divide that by 365 days in a year, we're having about 194 Americans overdose and die every single freaking day in our country. And we still can't get people to become aware of this problem and take it seriously to do something about it. Now we've got states that want to allow Americans, and believe me, I'm in favor of cheaper prescriptions, but they want to allow Americans to use these online pharmacies, particularly Canadian online pharmacies, which is a misnomer because those Canadian online pharmacies are actually located in India, Pakistan, China. Mexico.
Yeah.
Right.
All the nice precursor companies.
And there's no quality control. We talked to the Canadians. Right. The Canadian says, hey, they're going to the U.S. We're not checking.
They can't check it. Go straight to the front door.
Yep. And real quick, guys, what hits home for me is you've heard the situations where, hey, I can't sleep at night. So a friend will say, hey, take this pill, man. I've learned, do not do that.
No.
A lot of situations, that pill that was bought on the black market, it's laced with fentanyl. You don't know how many families we've talked to that, you know, my kid, and good kids, I couldn't sleep. Here's a Xanax. There's one that just took a little piece of it. It was laced with fentanyl. That was it, man. I mean, just be careful.
One piece of advice out there. I mean, it used to be, you know, if you had a headache, you'd accept an aspirin from somebody, a friend, or just like you said, a Xanax or whatever. You're having trouble sleeping. Don't accept anything from anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, you just don't know what you're getting nowadays. Sure. So
great advice.
Partnership for Safe Medicines has had us up on Capitol Hill twice in the last 2 years, once in the front of the House and once in front of the Senate. So that's another thing we're working on. And our speaking business, you know, we don't want to be in competition with you because you're up on that.
Toyota, man.
Hey,
we're still
down there on like pour the coffee
there, man. Tell them.
Hey, one team, one fight, man. You guys are something, truly. I mean, if keep doing what you're doing. If you could tell, I'll tell you what, looking back and all the stuff that you've been through, man, and hard times and the good ones, if you could pass one lesson learned down to any of all our listeners, what would that be?
Yeah, you know what? And I think it's your motto, do not give up. Absolutely. And there's many times we wanted to give up. We wanted to tell the government, let Pablo Escobar surrender. But then when you would see the innocent people get killed, you would see your friends get killed. It just, you couldn't do it. Do not, you know, you had to stay in that fight.
Yeah, and I agree. I can't think of a better lesson that we learned from that whole thing. And it's like you say at the introduction of your shows. You know, it's all about your work ethic. It's all about getting out there and trying to do the right thing. Are we still doing the right thing now that we're retired? We think we are. We don't know if we are, but we're not going to quit. We're not going to give up on this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's just how it's supposed to work. A lot of people get in those tough situations and they'll be like, well, they're ready to move on because they're thinking somebody else is supposed to handle it. Well, I mean, that's why we get put in the positions that we do, because we were the ones supposed to handle it. So you guys did that remarkably, man. You're still doing it. And if we can help you guys out in any way, we will. Trust me.
Thank you.
Hey, did you know Dave Cooper?
Which one? The short one?
Man, Master Chief.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Little Dave?
Oh, yeah. Little Dave.
Coop, yeah.
Coop, yeah.
We were doing a contract training team a few years ago. We were going down to Damneck as a three-day class about, you know, how working in the overseas
protocol.
Environment.
You know what I'm saying? Embassy.
Got to be friends with Coop and a bunch of the guys there at Damneck.
Yeah, a bunch of guys.
Yeah, they're great guys.
Oh, yeah. There's a reason why they're there, man. All of them are awesome.
Oh, they're phenomenal. You guys, you, not just because we got you here on the screen, but you fucking guys are heroes.
Shit, Noel. You know, it's amazing. We just like y'all.
We tell everybody in our shows, if we're ever kidnapped, based on our experience with you guys and with Delta, if we're ever kidnapped, you guys are the ones who want to come and get us, not these others.
Right. Well, I mean, if you put all those first responder uniforms together, you get camouflage. It's a forever uniform. Yeah. We just get to put our name on it. I mean, you pull all those colors out, you get y'all, and we're just kind of like a police force that gets to go over to the other countries to operate just like you guys. I mean, same thing. We're just an extension. Yeah, we just watch each other's backs.
Right. Thank you for the work you've done. Yeah.
All right, guys. Have a great day. Great weekend.
God bless y'all, man.
God bless.
Thank y'all very much.
Thank you.
See you.
You know, you really don't hear much about the, you know, most people don't even know there's Americans on site when that Escobar thing went down. It's cool to talk to the two guys that were leading the charge for the American side.
Well, I mean, they're making shows about it, and there's books and all kinds of movies about him. And kind of over time, you get to see the detailed part of it and them being a part of that and sharing that with us. Yeah, that was awesome, man. And now, especially what they're doing, they just kind of never stop going on adventures.
Yeah, that next adventure like seems
secondhand
cool.
Lions. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about? It's just kind of like rolled with each other and chasing the adventure. Oh, man, that's awesome. Guys never stop doing that.
Yeah, thank y'all for being on. Story was awesome.
Yeah, I wish we had more time. There's a lot more details in there, I'm sure.
If you want to be the first one to know when we drop a new episode, then you need to make sure you subscribe to the podcast. You can press the purple subscribe button on Apple Podcasts or any other major podcast player to be notified the moment we release a new episode. The show is available on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and pretty much any other podcast player. We've got a ton of great episodes and had some incredible guests, including J.J. Watt, David Goggins, and LaDamian Washington.
If you're already following us on Facebook and Instagram, you know we're going to keep our followers up to date with new gear, new sales, new guests, new events, and tons of other stuff you're not going to get anywhere else. If you're not following us yet, you're missing out. Follow us right now at @team_neverquit. You can also keep up with Marcus at Marcus Luttrell, Morgan at Mojo Luttrell, and me at Andrew Brockenbush on Instagram. Thanks for coming back to another episode. It's fun to do this every week, and you guys' stories, you guys' involvement in this community and part of our team is what keeps us coming back.
Well, we truly can't thank y'all enough for listening to not only us but our guests and keeping this thing going. It's an amazing thing, and we love you guys for it. God bless. I'm out.
Out here. Thank you.
Imagine a single cream that addresses all your skincare needs. Wrinkles, dark circles, age spots, and more. Introducing Caviar Gone Skin Cream, the only argon, caviar, and retinol formula on the market. Packed with pure Moroccan argon oil, collagen-boosting caviar extract, and retinol, Caviar Gone deeply hydrates, firms, and rejuvenates without the irritation of traditional retinol. Trusted by women over 45, Caviar Gone delivers visible results in just weeks. Smoother, firmer, more radiant skin. It's not just possible, it's proven. Visit CaviarGone.com today to claim your jar at up to 72% off. That's CaviarGone.com. Again, that's CaviarGone.com. Experience the luxury your skin deserves.
For a limited time, we're giving away a free Guasha system, a $70 value, with all triple bundle orders.